Oliver Darcy is an American journalist covering media and politics. In August 2024, he didn't renew his contract and left his job as a senior media reporter at CNN to start Status, an independent daily newsletter about the media industry. Status is already a success story with tens of thousands of subscribers, a few scoops that made the journalistic rounds, and a growing trajectory of adding content and people. I'm Panagiotis Menegos, and in this episode of Smalltalk, I'm its podcast featuring conversations about a world that is changing faster than we can keep up with. I'm talking with Oliver Darcy about Donald Trump's second 101st days in office, his boisterous relationship with the media, and journalism stepping into the so-called creator-based economy. So, Oliver, thank you very much for doing it.
I'm happy to be here. Excited.
Perfect. Let's start with this first 100 days of the second Trump presidency. First thing that pops in mind to describe it.
First thing that pops in mind is I think it's worse than most people had imagined. I think that a lot of people wrote off a lot of the president's bluster during the campaign and didn't think he'd actually do some of the things that he's doing. And turns out he wasn't joking. He wasn't exaggerating. He is following through on precisely what he campaigned on. And it's a very radical agenda. And I think it's certainly has a lot of autocratic flavors. And that's deeply alarming.
Can you describe a little bit the sociopolitical climate that these first 100 days have produced?
I mean, the social political climate, I think there is a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of worry that we've only been in this now for 100 some days. I mean, we have four more years. That's a long time. This is not ending over the summer or in the fall. You know, this is going to be something that Americans have to live with until 2029. And so I almost think it's starting to just settle in what everyone's in for. But the first 100 days have been absolutely chaotic, whether it's Elon Musk just taking a hatchet to the federal government and dispensing with programs like USAID, slashing costs elsewhere. I mean, there was that report that, for instance, they had slashed costs at a nuclear facility and then they had to rehire those people back. I mean, it has been chaotic on that point. And then you also look at what the president's been doing in terms of warping the systems that protect the law and order. So he's installed two cronies at the FBI, Dan Bongino and Kash Patel. And these guys are both extremists who have spread a number of conspiracy theories about the FBI and law enforcement over the years, and now they're running it. They have taken extraordinary measures to silence any potential critics and to purge them from the federal government. I mean, you go down the line, we don't have all day, obviously, but if you almost go every single department, whether it's the Health and Human Services that's been taken over by the anti-vaxxer RFK, who couldn't even say the other day that he would have his child vaccinated for measles, or you go to the DHS where Kristi Noem is like now apparently establishing this new like Hunger Games sort of thing. I don't know if you saw that report the other day. I mean, you go down the line, it is wild, but it's also, it feels like every single facet of American government now has this, it's almost like these people who don't seem to believe in American values leading them. And there's the English language is running out of words to describe this thing because concerning and alarming just don't cut it. I think that Americans took for granted the fact that the federal government worked. And now that it's being disrupted, I think it's going to be a wake-up call for a lot of people. I think the question is whether Donald Trump's base, or at least a portion of it, ultimately turns on him. Because look, the guy was elected on getting costs down. That's like the main reason he was elected. And costs outside the disturbing authoritarian stuff that Donald Trump wants to do, costs, everyday costs are going up. And I imagine that's going to alienate some people who voted for him.
Yeah, his popularity ratings seems to be in a constant fall since the beginning of this presidency.
I still think it's shockingly high, to be honest. I mean, I know it's at a historic low, but I still think it's shockingly high given that everything he's doing, that so many people are willing to stick with him. I mean, again, like, it's like every, I mean, whether it's insulting Zelensky, or you remember that in the Oval Office, that was embarrassing, accepting a $400 million Qatari jet. I mean, everything, it seems like he's doing everything possible for people not to have confidence in him. I mean, any other president, can you imagine if Donald Trump, if Joe Biden accepted a $400 million Qatari jet? And it's to me shocking that a third of the country is willing to stand by his side, no matter really what he does. There's no one really that is leading the Democratic Party in an effective way right now. And so if they could consolidate support around someone who's, you know, able to talk to the American people and explain some stuff, I think that might help as well, but we'll see.
If you had to focus on the media and their treatment by the Trump administration, what would you say? What's the right word to talk about it? Is it hostility? Is it persecution? Is it correction, some say?
I think it's, so I would separate the media is such a obviously broad umbrella. I think that journalists, by and large, are doing their best to hold Donald Trump's administration to account. I think on a day-to-day basis, reporters are, they are drinking from a waterfall and they're doing their best. I think what has been disturbing in the first 100 days and even before Donald Trump was formally inaugurated is that the parent companies, the owners of a lot of these organizations have shown they are happy to bend the knee in Donald Trump's favor. So you look at Patrick Soon-Shiong, the owner of the LA Times, what he's doing over there. He's happy. He desperately wants Donald Trump's approval, and he's happy to move his organization in a way that goes, is friendlier toward MAGA. Whether it's Jeff Bezos and the things he's doing at the Washington Post, whether it's Bob Iger settling a lawsuit against George Stephanopoulos, or you look at even the moderation of CNN, or you look at particularly, I think, Sherry Redstone's doing over at Paramount with 60 Minutes and wanting to settle this absurd, frivolous lawsuit that Donald Trump filed against the news magazine. And the fact
that resulted to the resignation of Billy Owens.
Yeah, exactly. The executive producer who felt like the company, he said it, the corporation did not have his back. He was not wanted at that corporation. And so I think the alarming thing is that the people with the most power in society that own these institutions, whether the corporate parent or the billionaire class, they're immediately buckling under pressure, just the threat of pressure. And that's been true in the media sector, and I think you can also talk about it in the legal sector and the education community. Donald Trump's assaulting the pillars of a democratic society. It's alarming because this is like the stuff you read about in dystopian novels, right? Where the autocratic wannabe gets in and he goes after the universities, the media, the law, the legal center of power. And Donald Trump's doing exactly that. And I think the disturbing thing, if we're talking about it from a media standpoint, is that these companies have shown that they are happy to do what they need to appease Donald Trump so that they can effectively line their own pockets a little better.
Two things on that, on these parent companies bending the knee to Donald Trump. Is this something new, or it was always happening and it was better hidden in the past? This is the first. And the second one, I'm wondering if this decline of legacy media independence, let's say, is something inevitable since big tech has entered this chat, this market.
Yes. I think that those two questions are very connected. I think there's a confluence of factors that has led us to this. One is the fact that these media organizations are weaker than they've ever been because of big tech. And so these companies, their business models are really collapsing from under their feet. And so whether it's television, where the cable bundle is going the way of the dinosaur, or whether it's newspapers, which is still struggling with the internet revolution, right? These companies, and digital media too, digital media has had a very difficult time. Particularly as Google and Meta have sucked up all the ads and formed a duopoly in the United States in that regard. And so from every sort of arena where media is in, like the business model is not good. And as a result, these companies are weaker than they've ever been. And as a result, they need to do deals. And so if you, I think the Sherry Redstone 60 Minutes example is perfect, because Sherry Redstone, so 60 Minutes is a division of CBS News, and CBS News is a division of Paramount Global. And Paramount Global has been one of these companies that has been entirely upended by the Netflix revolution, by streaming. And for them to survive, realistically, that company has lost, you know, more than 50% of its value in the last several years. So for that company to survive, it needs to basically have more scale and merge with another company, which is exactly what Sherry Redstone, who controls Paramount, is trying to do. She's trying to merge with Skydance Media and create a bigger company, more scale, so that their Paramount library can maybe compete better against Disney and Netflix and Amazon. And so would she be doing this if her business hadn't been disrupted by the big tech players? I would consider Netflix generally to be a tech company. Probably not. No, she wouldn't be. And thus, she wouldn't need the government's approval for a deal. And therefore, she'd be less at the whim of Donald Trump. You know, if she was running a hugely powerful, profitable company, they wouldn't really need the federal government in the same way they do right now. Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns CNN, wouldn't need the federal government because they wouldn't be needing to have deals approved down the pipeline. You go down the list, these companies are very weak. And so I think that has made them much more vulnerable to the political pressures. At the same time, Donald Trump has ratcheted up the pressure from the federal government in an unprecedented way. You never have seen a president really seek to push the press in this way, make them fall in line. And so I think this combination of factors has led to this point where business executives are looking at the landscape and they don't feel, to some extent, like they have much of a choice, because these news divisions are very tiny pieces of a much larger company. And if they want this larger company to survive, and really that also includes these news divisions, they feel like they need to do these things to get government approval. The only reason that Paramount Global and Skydance have not completed their deal is because Brendan Carr at the FCC, the Trump-appointed chairman of that agency, is holding up that deal. And the reason, it, you know, he won't say this and they'll deny it, but the reason really they're holding up that deal is because Donald Trump has filed a lawsuit against 60 Minutes and he wants that settled. And I think once that lawsuit is settled, then this deal will miraculously get approved by the federal government. And so, I don't know, there's a confluence of factors here, but it all goes back to a very disturbing weaponization of government that Donald Trump is using, and he's using it to push the press in a way that's less combative, less critical of him, so he can push through his extremist agenda.
Is this stance, this strategy of Trump's administration, something that works to his avail, because he has managed over the past decade to completely vilify the media and to turn them into enemies, at least in his core supporters' eyes?
Yeah, I think that certainly worked to his favor. I think that he set the table over the last decade for these kinds of moves. I'm not sure if the American people would have tolerated him going to these extreme actions 10 years ago. I think it's sort of like the cliche frog in boiling water, you know, analogy, where it's slowly getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and it's more difficult to shock the public into awareness when it just gradually, you know, increases the pressure on media. I mean, I think...
Yeah, what I want to say is that American people, and of course I'm generalizing here, but they don't seem quite ready, and they don't seem ready to defend their media as probably they used to.
Yeah, I think that is a result of a lot of things, fragmentation of media, which is a result of the internet revolution, and, you know, and people being on TikTok and getting their news and information and entertainment from 1,000 different sources now. But I also think it's a result of this long campaign that Donald Trump has waged against the press for the last decade, and also a result of the way right-wing media has sought to disable the news media for much longer than the last decade, you know, really since the advent of Fox News. I do think, though, that there was an initial somewhat shock when if you remember back in Donald Trump's first term, when he called the press the enemy of the people. That was a headline everywhere. That was a big deal. Now he says it just left and right. He has desensitized the public to that term. And I think in the same way, he's desensitized the public to his attacks on the press. It's just
a bold statement that had been trivialized over the years.
And I think that's worked to his favor and allowed him to escalate and keep escalating. And at some point, you know, the people become numb to this sort of thing, and he can get away with more and more. And I obviously don't think the public should be numb to this. I think that the public probably should. It's shocking to me, I think, that given everything he's doing, it you know, there aren't like mass protests. Like, it just doesn't, you know, compute in a way. You could go down the list of reasons why that might be. Part of it, I think, is everyone's numb to this at this point. And I think the other thing is, again, as we sort of discussed in the beginning of this, Americans are used to democracy working. They don't think bad things, I think, can happen here. And this is obviously the trap that a lot of people have fallen into throughout history, where they only react after it's too late. And that's a big worry.
So in this, if not dystopian, let's say pessimistic landscape, media landscape, what makes you keep on pursuing the next scoop?
Well, I think you don't, in the face of a lot of this pessimistic landscape, the answer is not to just quit, right? The answer is to continue to pursue the truth, to aggressively hold power to account, to hold the line, right? And so that's one. I firmly believe that the press should be very much shining a bright light in these power corridors where these decisions are being made, because they end up impacting a lot of people. They impact how I cover the media itself. So I'm covering how the news media is made, how information is distributed, how even Hollywood can shape the culture. And I'm sure a lot of these executives, as they are appeasing Trump or flying down to Mar-a-Lago or whatever, would prefer that people like me were not shining a bright light on them. But I think that it's important for us to do so. And so that keeps me motivated. I also happen to just have always been fascinated by media and the way it works. And so I very much enjoy covering it and writing about it and examining the trends. And there's a lot of things that interest me, whether it's the business aspect of the industry or whether it's the political aspects. And they obviously are intersecting in big ways right now, as we've discussed. But that keeps me motivated as well. And finally, I'd say, you know, I was at CNN for a while. I've been working in, I guess, the corporate press for some time. But now I'm independent. And, you know, I think that there is a when you have skin in the game every day, I think that also motivates you to get that next scoop, to write that next story, because you see the results, and it's your company that you're building. And it's a very exciting time for me, and it's a very fun thing to be building something that you own.
So I guess the answer is going back to the basics, going back to the romantic ideals you had when you started. And can you walk us through a little bit on this decision to go independent?
Sure. Yeah,
and start the Status newsletter.
Yeah. So I was at CNN. I was writing the Reliable Sources newsletter, which covers the same topics, media. And I had a very strong entrepreneurial itch. I wanted to do, I think, more than I could have done inside CNN. And I had been there for 7.5 years, and I just decided that, you know, if I couldn't do the things I wanted to do there, where could I do it? And maybe I should just do it on my own. And it was certainly a leap into the darkness, because you never know how many subscribers you get or how it's going to work. But I was confident that there was certainly a hunger for this kind of coverage. And thankfully, I've been proven right. And so, it's really cool for me. You know, I like controlling the brand. I like being able to do things on a whim and be very nimble. And certainly working at a large corporation like CNN provides you with all these sorts of resources and different pros. But also being nimble, there's something to be said about that. You know, we can do things that we couldn't do at CNN. You know, we have a shop, for instance. You can buy
Can you give a couple of examples?
Yeah, I've, even just being on this podcast with you, you know, at CNN, I'd have to ask the public relations officials to look at the request and, you know, the whole thing just to get approved. I think, you know, your team asked me, can I do this podcast? And I said, sure, let's do it. And I'm able to do that on a whim. I'm able to go speak at conferences without getting any approvals. I'm able to, we have the status shop where you can buy a t-shirt. We have, you know, we hired a designer and we did a limited edition First Amendment shirt, and we emailed and the Reporters Committee for Free Press and said, hey, we'd love to partner with you on this. We'll give you 50% of the proceeds to go to your legal defense fund that helps journalists in legal peril. What do you think? And they said yes, and we had it done within a day. You know, that would have taken weeks if it had been possible at CNN. You know, we're launching a podcast on our own. That's something you can't just do when you're at CNN. You know, we've had two events already, and that's something. So, like, you go down, there's a lot of things that being nimble and being independent on your own, like speedboat, allows you to do that when you're on the Titanic, or I don't, let's not say it's a Titanic, but
okay,
it's
yeah.
much larger. For some reason, I only think of big boats. I think of Titanic. It didn't end well there for everyone, so we don't want to say that. But, you know, when you're on a big aircraft carrier type thing, you know, it takes a lot of time to move. And I feel like we're on a little speedboat and we can do our own thing. And I don't think it's for everyone. And I think you certainly need those big vessels, you know, out there. I think that the world's better when there's a strong CNN and a strong Associated Press and, you know, all these big media organizations. But for a niche like media, I think that it's actually very beneficial to be on your own little boat.
Yeah, to sum up, I hear it as greater self-versatility, self-independence, self-expression. And if someone is a right-wing conspiracy theorist, we are calling them a right-wing conspiracy theorist.
Yes, that's also...
I've read you saying in an interview.
Yes, that's also true. I think that, unfortunately, you know, because of the political climate and because of all these pressures and business pressures and whatever, too often inside the legacy press, people who are extremists, people who are doing terrible things to American government or the information environment in which we live, I think they're not accurately described. And, you know, I wouldn't call someone like Dan Bongino a conservative host. I think that doesn't describe him to the American people for what he is. I mean, that man is an extremist and a conspiracy theorist. And there's a long list of examples that you can point to if you wanted to.
Language matters.
I think language matters a lot, particularly because a lot of people, you know, they watch the news, you know, they might consume the news through osmosis, or they might just, like, they're not watching Dan Bongino's show on a daily basis. So they rely on the people who do to accurately describe them. So they're like, oh, that's the conspiracy theorist. And for some reason, I don't know why, Alex Jones, for instance, is always called a right-wing conspiracy theorist. And, you know, and that's just, it's just always the way he's described. But, you know, there's so many people like him now in the government, frankly, in seats of power, and they're not referred to in the same way. It's almost arguably unfair to Alex Jones that every time he gets written up in a story or a news program covers him, he gets hit with this label. And then all the people who are equally as conspiratorial and extreme don't. And so I think that's one thing that we are doing at Status, and its benefit of being on our own, is we can be very clear-eyed about who these people who are now occupying seats of enormous power, who they are. And so our editorial certainly, I think, is very strong in a way that, you know, I could be at a bar and be talking to someone at a newspaper or a news organization, and they will agree that Dan Bongino is these things, but whether their organization will allow them to say it, I think that's another question.
On the other hand, just to play devil's advocate, don't you think that it's a little bit worrying that we're quickly stepping into this, I hate this lingo, but let's say creator-based economy, even in journalism? Don't you think that we are very much consumed in this misleading search for the progressive Joe Rogan or the Joe Rogan of the left?
You know, I'm a little mixed on this. I'd say that I think it's concerning that a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the places they get their information have no standards and are often misinforming them. I think it's good that there are people like me, you know, and others out there who are in this creator economy, so it's not just trash content. I actually think that if I were running a major news organization, I would be seeking to turn all my journalists into so-called creators. And I think it's strange that there aren't, you know, when I'm scrolling through TikTok or Reels or whatever, when you're doing that, I think it's strange that the people that you end up coming across talking about politics are not actual reporters. They're not journalists with sources. And those people are like relegated to like the 1990s, 2000s model of being on like a broadcast linear program on television and not filming and distributing the information they have in the way that everyone else is consuming it these days. And so if I were a major, the boss of a major news organization, I would have my reporters be all over. You know, that'd be a major initiative is that we're going to be posting every single day on these short form video platforms and we're going to be flooding the zone. And I want, when someone's scrolling through their feed at the end of the night or when they're on the toilet and they're scrolling through their feed mindlessly, I want them coming across a CBS News reporter or a CNN reporter or an ABC News reporter or a Los Angeles Times reporter. And I want that to be the information they consume because these are the people with actual sources who are actually covering this thing with expertise. I don't want them finding, you know, the random person, you know, the random troll who's just seeking to divide. And so I don't know. I think it's alarming, I guess, that we've been, that there is no, that people consume information from all these places and they're not really getting it often from good sources. But I also think it's incumbent on the people running these big news organizations to actually meet people where they are. And that's something they say a lot, but it's not something they actually do. Because as far as I'm aware, there's not some mega news like influencer really out there. There's not a reporter like, you know, filming in the same like YouTube style set that like a Candace Owens is, right? And I don't know why that is.
Are all these developments happening due to this gigantic lack of trust for media outlets? Is this a period where people only trust other people and not institutions?
I think it's mixed more than people think. I think certainly like when something big happens in the world, generally people will turn on more authoritative or be at least open. Like I think if there was like a, you know, natural disaster or like a terror attack, people would listen generally to what CNN's reporting generally. And so I think they trust the brand in that way. I think when it comes to politics, that's when things get a little more dicey and the trust in big brands goes down considerably, particularly among Republicans. And they're more likely to trust sources that reinforce their worldviews. And so that's when you get into the creator economy. And unfortunately, a lot of our news, most of our news is politically, you know, focused. And because of everything happening in Washington, so it's a lot of politics. And so that means that we see these brands as not being trustworthy. I think they're trustworthy in some regards. But in politics, people tend to want their viewpoints reinforced. And if you're a Donald Trump supporter, you do not want to listen to someone who's going to be contradicting what is this worldview that's been built up by him and his propagandists. So that's where you get into the creators. I also think that having a face on something, you know, like our readers, like they've been reading me for several years. They know where I stand, I think, on a lot of these issues. It's not really so much as my opinion, I think, on the stuff. It's that they know that we call balls and strikes regardless of who we're writing about. And that they know that we don't back under pressure. And I think that matters to audience as well. And so there's something valuable about being a person. And, you know, I respond to I try to respond to everyone that emails us, all our subscribers. And so, you know, we're not a faceless corporation. We're human beings. And I think that helps, certainly.
Is this, is Status Newsletter in one-man orchestra or you work with other people as well?
It was a one-person band for the beginning. And thankfully, we've been experiencing a good amount of success. And so we were able to bring on John Passantino, who is the former editor I worked with at CNN, who is editing Reliable Sources. And so he started earlier this year, and he's the executive editor. And so we're now a two-person band, but we're hoping certainly to expand over time. We haven't taken any financial backing, no investments or anything. It's just we're a reader-supported publication. And so we're going to expand responsibly and not
end up as a philharmonic or something like that.
Right. Maybe we'll get there one day, but we're not doing that overnight. We're going to be expanding within our means, and now especially with this economy, you have to look around and make sure that you don't expand too quickly, and then things go south from an economic standpoint. So, but certainly the goal is for this not to just be a one or two man band, but to eventually bring others into the fold. And I think we'll get there. It's just going to take a little bit of time, and we're going to do it responsibly.
Okay, Oliver, thank you very much. I think we've touched a lot of interesting ground, and your answers made us think about certain things about the modern media landscape. Once again, thank you very, very much.
I appreciate you having me, and anyone who wants to sign up for our newsletter, where we cover this stuff on a nightly basis, you can just go to status.news and sign up for that newsletter.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mixed and sound design by Aris Athanasopoulos. Produced by Panagiotis Menegos. You can listen to more podcasts by visiting podcast.imed.org.